This evening I introduce my sermon by talking about something about which I know very little. You might think, well, that's not a good way to start your sermon, talking about things that you really don't know all that much about. But the topic that we want to focus our attention on quite briefly is a topic that I personally dislike. It's a topic that I normally wouldn't even talk about. And you might be wondering, well, what is this topic that Pastor really doesn't like? And maybe as you see the title of my sermon, maybe you have a clue as to what this topic is. It's the topic of horror stories, or horror novels, or horror movies. Okay, so that's the overall topic that we're going to talk about just very briefly as I introduce my sermon. And I imagine I'm not the only one that dislikes this topic. I realize that there are any number of people that are somehow gravitating toward this genre of writing and cinema, genre of horror movies, horror stories. Some people love reading books like books written by Stephen King or others. Personally, I've never read any of his books. There are certain people that enjoy watching horror movies, movies that shock and terrify, movies that depict the most gruesome of events, the most demented and evil of characters. And honestly, I have no desire to read a horror story or to watch a horror movie. I don't recommend that you read or watch them either, as far as these things that are sold and displayed. You know. And so I have no interest in things such as this. I have no enjoyment in being terrified. And maybe there are some out here that I'm talking to that enjoy being terrified. Is there any, just to get an idea of my audience here, I'm assuming that there aren't many of us, if any of us, that enjoy being terrified, but are there any out here that enjoy horror stories? So I was thinking that probably would be the case, but you just never know. So I have no desire to fill my mind with scenes of vicious evil and perverted wickedness. I have no desire at all. Now, looking back to my younger days, I read at least one rather dark novel in high school for one of the classes. I wouldn't call it a horror story by any means, but it was very dark. I've watched some TV shows that you could consider creepy or sinister, and I wouldn't choose to read that novel that I read back in high school. I wouldn't choose to read that now. I wouldn't personally watch the TV shows that at one time I watched, as far as those creepy or sinister TV shows. But looking back at those things that I did watch, or that novel that I read, or just talking about these horror stories or horror movies, these are things I don't want to see. I don't want to read. But these things do portray sin and wickedness and perversity. All these things that are part of our fallen world, they portray these things, the sin, the wickedness, the perversity of our fallen world, in a very vivid way, a very shocking way. And some might say, well, the scenes that are presented in these horror stories are so terrible, so demented, so far out, that they could never be anything but fiction. And in some cases, that may be the case. But we all realize that history is filled with any number of events that are very much as terrible and as horrific as any made-up story. So we consider the atrocities committed by Nazi Germany upon the Jewish people, and those atrocities put many a horror story to shame, don't they? How many others in history have done acts that are exceptionally shocking and terrifying? And truly, this fallen world of ours, this world that's filled with wicked sinners, this fallen world filled with wicked sinners has written countless horror stories of their own, and they're anything but fiction. Now, men and women, we should rightfully cringe whenever we hear horror stories. That should be true of us. It should be true of everybody. Men and women should be appalled at the absolute depravity of the human heart, the exceptional perversity of fallen men and women, the terrible extent of mankind's rebellion against God. But the fact that some people are entertained by horror stories, they're entertained by them and not disgusted by them, in my way of thinking, is a warning signal that perhaps not everything is well with those people that are entertained by horror stories, as opposed to being appalled by them. And so this is a somewhat short introduction to my sermon this evening, and yes, much more could be said, but our attention now is directed toward the Bible, and the sermon that I'm going to preach this evening is a challenging one, Because we go to the book of Judges chapter 19, and perhaps of all the chapters in the Bible, this is one of the darkest chapters, if not the darkest chapter. Judges chapter 19 is what we could call a true life horror story. The subject matter in this chapter may very well appall us. It should sicken us. It should make us uncomfortable. But yet the subject matter of this chapter is given to us by God. And God had a good reason to include this subject matter in the Bible. God wants us to learn from the events of this very dark and this very sinful time in Israel's history. I invite you to turn with me, if you haven't already done so, to Judges chapter 19. If you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's page 300. And our passage begins with the events recorded in verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim, who took to him a concubine out of Bethlehem, Judah. And his concubine played the whore against him, and went away from him unto her father's house to Bethlehem, Judah, and was there 4 whole months. Now with these two verses, we have a new episode beginning here in the book of Judges. The previous account ended with chapter 18. We have the episode of chapter 17 and 18, which records a time in Israel's history, some events that were by no means good. In that previous story, we read about deception and idolatry. We read about theft and warfare and conquest. And we have the testimony of chapter 17, verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. In those days, there wasn't a king in Israel. There wasn't a king to lead Israel in the right path that they should go. Neither was there a king in Israel to lead people on the wrong path that they should go. There is no king. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And as we consider Judges chapter 17 and 18, and really as you look at the whole book of Judges as a whole, to do what is right in one's own eyes is to do what is terribly wrong in God's eyes. That is what is meant by saying every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so we come to a new story here in chapter 19, and we read that there's something that happened in these days of the judges, in these days in which there is no king in Israel. Now, as we begin chapter 19, there is nothing that says that every man did what is right in his own eyes, but I think that that is very clearly the case, even though it doesn't say it in so many words. People were doing what was right in their own eyes. And it's because people were doing what was right in their own eyes as opposed to doing what was right in God's eyes. It's because people were setting their own standards of right and wrong, doing as they thought was best. That is how we have the horror of this chapter, the terror of this chapter, and the following chapters even. In those days, there was a certain Levite. This Levite was sojourning in the hill country of Ephraim. He had taken for himself a concubine from the south country, from Bethlehem, Judah. And so far, we don't have any reason to think either good or ill concerning this Levite. The only thing that may cause us to pause for a minute is because previously in chapters 17 and 18, we came across a Levite who is by no means a godly man. And we wonder in our minds as we begin reading in chapter 19, is this Levite going to be different? Is this Levite going to be faithful to God? Is he going to serve God as he should? Or is he also going to do what is right in his own eyes? Now, this Levite had taken a concubine for himself, a concubine from the south country, from Bethlehem, Judah. And no sooner is that fact announced than we read this unhappy news that the concubine played the whore against him. This concubine was unfaithful to him. She left him. She went to her father's house in Bethlehem, Judah. She stayed there for a period of 4 months. And as we read these two verses, it seems like the story thus far is quite straightforward. It's sad because we have this Levite taking for himself a concubine, but the concubine is playing the whore, is being unfaithful to him, leaves him, and goes to her father's house. And there have been some that have wondered whether the young woman, this concubine, actually committed sexual immorality against her husband, or whether she only left her husband, maybe because her husband was harsh toward her. Some have suggested such a thing, and they suggest that the simple act of leaving her husband would be equated with unfaithfulness, even if no adultery had been committed. Some would suggest that. Now, is that the case? I'm not so sure that it is. But it is very clear that this man's concubine left him. 4 months then passed, and then we read this in verses 3 and following. And her husband arose and went after her to speak friendly unto her and to bring her again, having his servant with him and a couple of asses or donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the damsel saw him, she rejoiced to meet him. And his father-in-law, the damsel's father, retained him, and he abode with him 3 days. So they did eat and drink and lodged there. And it came to pass on the fourth day, when they rose early in the morning, that he rose up to depart. And the damsel's father said unto his son-in-law, comfort thine heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way. And they sat down and did eat and drink both of them together. For the damsel's father had said unto the man, be content, I pray thee, and tarry all night, and let thine heart be merry. And when the man rose up to depart, his father-in-law urged him, therefore he lodged there again. So here's this passage here, verses 3 and following, down through verse 7. It seems that perhaps all is going to go well for this Levite now. All is going to go well for this concubine. So after 4 months, the Levite determines to go south to Bethlehem, Judah, for his concubine. He has this plan in his mind, and he puts his plan into action. He would go south to Bethlehem. He would speak kindly to his runaway concubine. He would woo her back to himself. He comes with a servant. He comes with 2 donkeys. He's thought through what he needs to do, and he's prepared to do what is necessary to restore the relationship. The question is, though, perhaps what was in the Levite's mind is, how would my young concubine respond to my arrival? And as we read through the passage, there's nothing in so many words that describes her reaction, but it does say that she brought him into her father's house. So surely that's got to be a good sign. What's more, her father, the Levite's father-in-law, was very glad to meet him. The text says that the father-in-law rejoiced to meet him. The concubine's father warmly welcomes this Levite. He showers the best of hospitality upon him. So 3 days, we have the father-in-law and the Levite talking with each other and eating and drinking with each other. And on the fourth day, the Levite is determined to go back home. But the father, the concubine's father, presses upon him and encourages him, stay for a little while. And they enjoy another meal together. And even though the Levite wanted to go, he stayed the night. And so we read now, as we continue through the passage, verses 8 through 10, and he, referring to the Levite, rose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart. And the damsel's father said, comfort thine heart, I pray thee. And they tarried until afternoon, and they did eat both of them. And when the man rose up to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the damsel's father, said unto him, behold, now the day draweth toward evening, and I pray you tarry all night. Behold, the day groweth to an end. Lodge here, that thine heart may be merry, and tomorrow get you early on your way, that thou mayest go home. But the man would not tarry that night, but he rose up and departed, and came over against Jebus, which is Jerusalem, and there were with him 2 asses saddled. His concubine also was with him. Okay, so what have we had up to this point in time? The Levite has this concubine that is unfaithful. She runs away, goes to her father's house in Bethlehem. The Levite, after 4 months, decides, I'm going to go back for my concubine. When he gets to Bethlehem, his concubine invites him into her father's house. Her father opens his arms to the Levite, and for 3 days they have a great time together. The fourth day, the Levite wants to go home, but the father-in-law encourages him, stay longer, even stay the night. And that's what he does. But now day 5 has arrived, and it begins much the same way as day 4. The Levite gets up, he's ready to go home. The father encourages him, urges him, stay for a meal. The Levite concedes. The father-in-law tells him, well, stay for the night again, it's getting late already. But the Levite this day was determined to leave. He wanted to get back home. And so he leaves, even though it's getting toward evening. He travels north toward the hill country of Ephraim. He's with his servants, his donkeys, his concubine, and now they're on their way. And before long, they make it to Jebus, or Jerusalem, a journey of 6 miles. And so we read now in verse 11, and when they were by Jebus, the day was far spent. And the servant said unto his master, come, I pray thee, and let us turn in into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. So the Levite, because of the father-in-law's hospitality and pressing upon him, the Levite didn't get an early start. he got a later start because he had already spent time with the father-in-law eating and drinking. And so there's no way they can make it back to Ephraim that day. No way. It was pretty much, the day was pretty much gone by the time they made it to Jebus or Jerusalem. And so with this in mind, the servant suggests that they spend the night there in Jebus or Jerusalem. It's the city of the Jebusites. But the master, the Levite, would have none of that, even as we read in verse 12. And his master said unto him, "We will not turn aside hither into the city of a stranger that is not of the children of Israel. We will pass over to Gibeah." Here's the Levite. He's an Israelite. The Levite is determined to spend the night, if he has to spend the night not in a city of foreigners, but rather in an Israelite city. So Jebus, Jerusalem, it was in that area of land allotted to the tribe of Benjamin. But Benjamin had never conquered Jebus. Even as we read in Judges chapter 1 and verse 21, the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. So here's the Levite on his way back home. It's getting dark. They need a place to stay. They're at Jebus. The servant suggests, well, let's stay here for the night. But the Levite is not willing to do that. Now, there were many Israelites, even as we read in Judges chapter 1, verse 21, the children of Benjamin the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. So there are any number of Israelites content to live among the foreigners, to make friends with them, to intermarry with them. You remember how Samson, he cozied up with the Philistines, didn't he? But this Levite seems to be different. He wanted nothing to do with the native peoples of the land. We can almost sense an attitude of disdain or contempt that this Levite has toward the Jebusites. I'm not going to stay with those foreigners, those people of the land. You know, if I'm going to spend the night anywhere, it won't be in Jerusalem. It will be further on in the way, even in Gibeah or Ramah. We'll stay in an Israelite city. So even if they have to travel 6 miles north to Gibeah, that's better than staying with these Jebusites. And so we read in verses 13 and 14, "And he said unto his servant, Come and let us draw near to one of these places to lodge all night, in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down upon them when they were by Gibeah, which belongeth to Benjamin." And we can picture in our minds this little party arriving at the city of Gibeah. The sun was setting even as they approached, and as they entered the gates, it was getting dark. So they're not home, but at least they're among fellow Israelites. They're thinking, surely this is a good place to spend the night. We're among fellow Israelites. This is a safe place. But we continue reading in verse 15, "And they turned aside thither to go in and to lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat him down in a street of the city, for there was no man that took them into his house to lodging." Now in those days, as you're very well aware, there weren't hotels on every corner where you could stay and spend the night. Travelers depended on the hospitality of others to invite them into their houses so that they could stay the night. So they come to Gibeah. They're there. It appears that they're in the open square, and even before that perhaps, nobody takes them in. No one greets them with open arms. No one invites them into his house. So the Levite and his little band sat down in the street or the open square of the city, and they're thinking, well, perhaps we're going to spend the night under the stars. Perhaps that's what they're thinking. But before that faint light of day, or faint light of dusk rather, gave way to the darkness of night, someone else came through the gates of Gibeah. And we read this in verse 16. "And behold, there came an old man from his work out of the field at evening, which was also of Mount Ephraim, and he sojourned in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he had lifted up his eyes, he saw a wayfaring man in the street of the city. And the old man said, Whither goest thou? And whence comest thou? And he said unto him, We are passing from Bethlehem, Judah, toward the side of Mount Ephraim. From thence am I. And I went to Bethlehem, Judah, but I am now going to the house of the Lord. And there is no man that receiveth me to house. Yet there is both straw and provender for our asses, and there is bread and wine also for me, and for thy handmaid, and for the young man which is with thy servants. But there is no want of anything. And the old man said, Peace be with thee, howsoever let all thy wants lie upon me, only lodge not in the street. So he brought him into his house, and gave provender unto the asses, and they washed their feet, and did eat and drink. This man who came in through the gates of Gibeah at night was none other than a man from Ephraim. He had been sojourning there in Gibeah for some time, it appears. This man was not a young man like the Levite, wasn't young like the concubine. This was an old man, but yet strong enough to go work in the fields. And he came in from probably what was a hard day's work. He saw the Levite, he saw his little troop in the city square, and he strikes up a conversation with him, and he finds out that the Levite was sojourning in Ephraim, and what had brought him to Gibeah, and what was going on here, and this old man learned that no one had been so kind as to invite him in and his company in for the night. The Levite said, "I have plenty of food, I have plenty of drink, I have plenty for us and for our animals." And can you imagine the Levite how relieved he would have been when he heard the old man tell him, "I would be honored to have you stay with me at my house. Don't stay in the open square, stay with me in the house." And probably the Levite thought very little of what the old man said as far as don't stay in the open square. I think he was just happy to have a house to spend the night in. And how nice it would have been to wash his feet, and all of the ones with him wash their feet, sit down and eat and drink with this old man from Ephraim. And maybe it seemed to the Levite that he was at home, even though he was away from home. Things seemed to be going quite well for the Levite up until this point. Even looking back over the past several days, he made it to Bethlehem. He found his runaway concubine. His concubine invited him into her father's house. He hit it off well with the father-in-law. It seemed like they hit it off too well. It was hard to get away from the father-in-law. You know, the father-in-law just wanted him to stay longer and longer and longer. And it's because of that father-in-law's overzealous hospitality, we could say. That's why he got such a late start. That's why they had to stay the night in Gibeah. And at first it didn't seem like Gibeah was a good place to stay, but now they are in the house of the old man. It seemed as if things were going quite well. They were enjoying themselves now. But now with verse 22, we realize not all is well in Gibeah. Now as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, certain sons of Belial, beset the house round about and beat at the door and spake to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring forth the man that came into thine house, that we may know him." Now when the Levite and his party first entered Gibeah, they hoped that they would be warmly greeted, but no one invited them in right away. We wonder how many people passed by them, how many people stopped to talk with them. Did anyone give reasons as to why they couldn't invite them into the house? You know, did it seem like people were shunning them or ignoring them? We don't know for sure. But now that they're in the old man's house, they're having a good time eating and drinking and talking. They're having a good time. But all of a sudden, the atmosphere suddenly changes, because now surrounding the house are certain sons of Belial. We could say that they're sons of worthlessness. These are men of the city. These are men without worth. These are the men who refused to take the Levite into their homes and be hospitable to him. These are the same men that are demanding that the Levite be brought out to them. These men are beating on the old man's door. They're crying out to the old man who comes out to talk with them. Bring out that man who you invited in. Bring him out so that we may know him. And in saying that they wanted to know him, they were saying that they wanted to have sex with him, to rape him. And so we are continuing in our passage here, verse 23. And the man, the master of the house, went out unto them. And actually, I said that the old man went out to them before, but that he hadn't gone out yet by this time. Now we read that he went out unto them and said unto them, "Nay, my brethren, nay, I pray you, do not so wickedly, seeing that this man is come into mine house. Do not this folly. Behold, here is my daughter, a maiden, and his concubine. Them will I bring out now, and humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you, but unto this man do not so vile a thing." Okay, so what was the scenario before? These men of Gibeah surrounding the house, these worthless men, pounding on the door, demanding that the old man bring the Levite out so that the men from Gibeah could rape him. So here's this old man. He hears the vile demands of the people of Gibeah. He goes out to talk with them. He appeals to them. He begs them, "Don't do such a wicked thing." Yes, he had invited this man, the Levite, into his house. This Levite with his guest. And such a vile thing as this that they demanded must not be done. The old man, in desiring to protect the Levite, offered to give these men of Gibeah his own daughter. He offers to give the man's concubine to them. And the old man says, you can humble these ones. You can do with them as you wish. But don't do such a thing to this man. Don't do this to my guest. To do that is unthinkable. It's outrageous. Okay, so what was a happy evening to begin with had now become quite the nightmare. But this wasn't any dream. This was reality. This was terrible reality. And the narrative goes on. But the men would not hearken to him. So the man took his concubine and brought her forth unto them. And they knew her and abused her all the night until the morning. And when the day began to spring, they let her go. Now the old man had offered his own daughter to the Gibeonite men. He had offered the Levite's concubine to the men of Gibeah. But they would have none of that. What they wanted was the man that was in the house. And the Levite, understanding how serious matters were, he determined to take matters into his own hands. And so he grabs his concubine, he takes her to the door, he hands her over to the vicious mob. And all night, these men from Gibeah raped her and abused her. And only when the sun began to break did they let her go. And then we read what we do in verse 26. Then came the woman in the dawning of the day and fell down at the door of the man's house where her lord was till it was light. And her lord rose up in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way. And behold, the woman, his concubine, was fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. And he said unto her, up, let us be going. But none answered. Then the man took her up upon an ass, and the man rose up and gat him unto his place. So we don't even want to imagine what happened at that night. We don't want to think about it. The horrors that that young woman endured. We have the beast-like men of Gibeah abusing her, raping her all night. And when they finally let her go, somehow she makes it back to the old man's house. And there she fell down at the door with her hands upon the threshold. And apparently the Levites had gone to bed that night. He had fallen asleep. He got up early in the morning. He was eager to continue his journey. He opens the door to leave, and there he saw his concubine with her hands on the door's threshold. And he sees her there. You'd expect, well, he'd fall down and embrace her. He would check her out to see how serious her injuries are. But he doesn't hold her close. He simply tells her to get up. It's time to go. But no answer came back from the young woman. So he picks her up, puts her on his donkey, and back they went to his home in the hill country of Ephraim. And then we read these two verses that close the chapter. And when he was come into his house, he took a knife and laid hold on his concubine and divided her together with her bones into 12 pieces and sent her into all the coasts of Israel. And it was so that all that saw it said, there was no such deed done nor seen from the day that the children of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt unto this day. Consider of it, take advice, and speak your minds. The Levite reached his long-awaited destination, and finally he got home. And when he got home, what did he do? He took his knife, he took a hold of his concubine, he divided her body into 12 pieces. And each piece he sent by a messenger throughout the land of Israel. So we have 12 messengers with the 12 pieces of the concubine's body sent throughout the land of Israel. And those who saw the messengers with their grisly parcels, they were shocked. Never had they seen or even heard of such a thing. No, not even since they had come from Egypt in their captivity there. This act demanded a response. It was a call to action. Now, stepping back and considering the story that we have just read, wouldn't you agree with me that this is indeed a horror story? This is not the production of someone's demented imagination. This really happened, and how terrible it was. We don't even want to ponder on it for too long because it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. It's horrific. But this is how things were in the days of the judges. This is what life was like when there was no king in Israel, when everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The story that's so horrific will even lead to more horror as we continue on to the next chapter and the chapter after that. But for this evening, we pause to consider how bad it is when men and women do what is right in their own eyes. To reject God, to live life according to what man thinks is right or what man thinks is good, that's horror indeed. So first of all, we'll consider the Levite's concubine. If we take the text at face value, she did what was right in her own eyes when she committed adultery and left her husband. Clearly that's against the will of God, the command of God. There's no excuse for such sin. And yet, as we consider the rest of the story, how tragic it is, the young girl seems to be virtually ignored. We read about the Levite and the father-in-law having a great time together, but what about the concubine? Where is she during that time? So the young girl seems to be virtually ignored. And then, as we have the event in Gibeah, she surrendered to the most vile of men to be raped and abused. And even in death, her body is not solemnly laid to rest. It's cut apart. It's sent throughout the land. Her body is treated more like an animal's body instead of a human body. Now we turn to the Levite. Initially, he appears in the narrative as a man who's wronged by his concubine. And he's intent on bringing her back. He leaves to bring her back by speaking kind words to her. But as we read through chapter 19, do we read anywhere of the Levite speaking kind words to the concubine? Now, maybe he did, but it's not recorded in the text. We have the father-in-law, the father of the concubine. We have the Levite's father-in-law, the two of them spending a good time together. But where's the concubine through all of this? And then we have the hideous men of Gibeah encircling the house. And the Levite, what does he do? Instead of protecting his concubine, what does he do? He gives her to the vicious beasts. It seems as if he is not thinking anything of her during the night. It seems like he went to bed and fell asleep. And then morning comes, he gets up, he opens the door, and the cold words that he speaks to her as she lay there on the threshold of the door, we wonder, does this Levite have a heart at all? And then we wonder, too, when did the concubine actually die? In the text, it doesn't tell us when she actually died. We have the Levite placing her on his donkey. We might assume, surely she had died at that point in time when the Levite placed his concubine on the donkey, but nothing is said in the text about her dying at that point in time. We'd think she surely was dead when the Levite did his gruesome work as far as dividing her body. But the question that lingers in minds is, can we safely assume anything during those dark days of the judges? There have been some that have suggested maybe she was alive yet whenever the Levite did his gruesome work. We don't know. But the Levite certainly was not a man who was doing what was right in God's eyes. He was doing what was right in his own eyes. The men of Gibeah, they're presented as brute beasts. First of all, demanding to rape the man who is visiting town, the Levites, and then they unleash their vile passions on the helpless concubine. Now, the Levite had assumed that the men of Gibeah would be good hosts to them, far better hosts than the Jebusites of Jerusalem. But what did the Levite find out? The Israelites were no better than the men of Sodom. So this is what life is like when people do what is right in their own eyes. This is how far people may digress when they reject God, when they give themselves over to their own passions, to their own standards of what is right and what is wrong. We have the men of Gibeah. Certainly they are detestable examples of horrific evil. But you consider the Levite. The Levite is certainly not a man to follow as far as a good example. We have the old man. He was hospitable, but what does he do in the end? He did what was right in his own eyes when he offered his own daughter and the Levite's concubine to the men of Gibeah. Okay? The old man was doing what was right in his own eyes. The concubine herself, our hearts go out to her certainly, but she was unfaithful. She left her husband. It seems that she was doing what was right in her own eyes as well. What a tragic, horrific story this is. But this is what Israel was like in the days of the judges. This is what life is like when people do what is right in their own eyes. Now, if you go to bookstores today, if you'd perhaps go to a theater, which I wouldn't even recommend that, but you turn on the TV, there's any number of horror stories that you could read or that you could watch. And any number of times, these horror stories are the product of wicked imaginations of wicked people. But how many people find entertainment in these stories, either reading them or watching them? But we realize all too much that horror is not just found in the pages of a fiction book or in a fiction movie. Horror is found when individuals and when nations do what is right in their own eyes. Now, sometimes the nature of their sin, as they do what is right in their own eyes, sometimes the nature of their sin is rather muted, we could say. But other times, the nature of their sin is very full-blown. And whenever we see sin in its full-blown form, I hope that we're shocked by it. I hope that we're sickened by it. We want nothing to do with such wickedness. But as we ponder what happened in Judges chapter 19, we'd say that's full-blown wickedness. Full-blown sin, if we want to call it that. But we need to realize as well that full-blown acts of wickedness often begin with much smaller acts, much smaller demonstrations of sin and perversity. When people do what is right in their own eyes, when they reject what is right in God's eyes, who knows the depths of evil and perversity and horror that will be reached. We consider our world today, and if you watch the news for any length of time, eventually you're going to hear about a true horror story. Why did things like this happen? You know, we've heard about any number of terrible, horrific things that terribly wicked men and women have done. Why do they do these things? Well, isn't it because they are doing what is right in their own eyes? We live today in a society in which what is right is called wrong, and what is wrong is called right. And how is that going to end up when people are doing what is right in their own eyes? Well, we know very well how things are going to turn out. It's not going to turn out well. Now, we should shudder at sin. We should draw back in horror at the thought of doing what is right in our own eyes, as far as our own sinful eyes. May we cling to what is good and hate what is evil. May we pray for those who have rejected God, who are living according to what they think is best. We know that God is a merciful God, and God saves the worst of sinners. We also know that God is a God who will judge in the end, and there will be no wicked people that get away with what they do. Judges chapter 19, not a very pleasant chapter by any means, but God has it in the Scriptures for a reason. We see people doing what is right in their own eyes, and as we continue in chapter 20 and chapter 21, people continue to do what is right in their own eyes. May we be a people who is committed to doing what God says is right. We might think, well, we never would go to the depths of sin as what we find in the book of Judges. But you consider, Judges is about Israel, God's people, doing what is right in their own eyes instead of doing what is right in God's eyes. As we continue on in the book of Judges, we realize that this event here in chapter 19 didn't happen very long into the period of the Judges. We think, well, surely people who are saved, people who are part of the church, surely they wouldn't go and do terrible things such as what we find in Judges chapter 19. And I hope the church wouldn't do something terrible like this. But whenever anyone, whether a believer or not, when anyone does what is right in their own eyes, it is really a cause for great concern. It is not a good thing. It is a terribly bad thing. And if a person starts doing what is right in their own eyes, it may start out little, but it could develop into something very bad, something very big, as far as full-blown sin, if we want to call it that. So may we as a people hate sin. May we as a people always determine to do what is right in God's eyes. And when we're tempted to do what's right in our own eyes and forsake God and go our own way, may we realize that's the wrong path to go down. That is a path that only leads to destruction and misery and horror. Judges chapter 19, not a pleasant chapter by any means, but a chapter that teaches us very clearly how terrible it is when a people, when individuals, do what is right in their own eyes instead of doing what is right in God's eyes. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are a good God, that you are just, that you are righteous. How terrible it is, how horrific it is whenever people decide to do what they think is best instead of doing what you think is best. Whenever people do the most terrible of sins, we know that all sin is terrible, but our hearts truly are just in shock. We are appalled when we see the acts of sin that are portrayed for us in Judges chapter 19. But I pray that we as believers would shudder at any form of sin, whether little in our minds or whether big in our minds. Help us to love your holiness. Help us to do what is right and good. Help us to be holy as you are holy. Help us to love you and others as you have loved us. Help us to always do what is right in your eyes and never do what is right in our own sinful eyes. Again, we thank you for what you've shown us today. We pray these things in Jesus' name.